There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Okay, sure, you betcha. Quick, Knut Skalvaker. We got to get to the Ludafisk Falcon with Oli von Svenobi and rescue that dare Princess Lena, by golly. Yimini, I sure hopes we don't run into that dare Durf Klader and his Ludafisk of Doom over there. Oh, crepes ya. The proceeding was, of course, a reading from the 1980 Scandahoovian science fiction epic Fighting Up in Dem Dare Stars, by golly. One of a raft of science fiction movies inspired by 1977's Star Wars. But did you know that Roger Corman, the featured player in our series Be Like the Corman, also felt the call to create a science fiction epic that just happened to come out the same year as The Empire Strikes Back? Coincidence? Or another example of Corman's visionary genius. Yes, this week we will be discussing the seminal and semiotic cinematic creation known as Battle Beyond the Stars. I'm your host, Max Ham Salad Levine, and over there sucking down the last of the blue milk is Mike Chuchilla the Wookiee Monster Loose. May the Varda be with you, Mike.
I prefer Chewbachman.
That's from the Jewish Star Wars.
Darth, wait a minute.
It's Han Solowitz. Yep. Princess Leia cats. Forget the Death Star. Let's shop.
Light cabers, anyone?
That's Scottish.
Oh.
But before we get into this titan of cinema, we have our poll question.
Poll question.
Last week, we asked you, what non-actor's performance pleasantly surprised you? And Tommy Wiseau does not count. Degsy O'Brien of the Degsy O'Brien Mysteries replies, Tina Turner in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, 1985. Oh, yeah. What could have been a throwaway role as payment for providing some songs for the movie, Tina added dimension and gravitas to her performance with just a few lines and expressions, elevating her villain status to iconic. Oh, you know, most people, you forget the character's name, which was Auntie Entity.
Well, there's a reason for forgetting it.
Everyone remembers Tina Turner in that. Well, yeah.
She also had a chain link dress.
Yes, she did, which weighed like 40 pounds. Seth Jacobs gives us LeBron James.
LeBron James. LeBron James. LeBron James.
Turn the vine off, please. In Trainwreck. Wow, I first off don't know that movie and didn't know he ever did a movie outside of, what is it, Looney, the remake of the Looney Tunes basketball movie.
Which is so good we can't remember the name.
Yep.
Spaceball? No, it wasn't Spaceball.
No, it could have been, but no.
Don't write us in. We'll remember in about 10 minutes.
We'll be like, oh, right.
Yeah, Space Jam.
Space Jam, that's right, the Next Generation or whatever the hell they called it.
Which, yeah, it immediately says basketball to me because jam equals basketball.
Yeah. Delicious Space Jam.
Space flavor.
Dave! Responded with Salman Rushdie on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea. Wow, I might say Truman Capote in Murder by Death, but it would be untrue. Oh, burn! Dave Byrne! Oh, ouch. Dan Schaefer of the law firm Dan Schaefeloff. Not a film, but Mark Maron had a role on an episode of Reservation Dogs. Oh, God, yeah, he did. And was surprisingly good at it. I thought it was him, but I had a lot of, is that really Mark Maron? Until I could confirm it in the episode credits.
Huh. Oh.
That's a good one. Yep.
Neat.
Nick Hoffman says Robin Williams in The World According to Garp, his first movie lead. Huh. Up till that point, he was just insanely funny. And then there was this. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's reasonable. He was a stand-up until that point.
Well, he'd done Mork and Mindy.
True. But he hadn't done any movies.
Adjacent to acting.
Not really. He was just doing his shtick for 22 minutes.
Yeah, and then all the other actors in the show would stand around trying to figure out what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, and trying not to laugh. J. Jessica Miller says David Bowie in Labyrinth. Oh, yeah. Except he had been acting for a while already.
Yeah, but he wasn't really known as an actor.
He was a musician. Yeah.
His position in The Man Who Fell to Earth was so bizarre. Ooh, I'm not even sure if you could consider it. I guess it was acting. Oh, but
we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Dr. Professor Rebecca Pelkey says Tina Turner in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Not a great film, but she was great in it. Who does run Bartertown?
It's Master Blaster. Just
yeah. What's that?
Master Blaster run Bartertown.
Thank you. Yes, he does.
What is that smell?
Kind of piggy. I think that's Blaster. I'm not sure.
Oh dear.
I think Master let loose a blaster.
Pig killer.
Val Coons, who's president, lord, and doyen of Q Footsteps, one of, if not the, no, not the, because that's us, greatest podcast out there, tells us, I'm going to go with a couple of more obscure names, Lyle Lovett and Sam Phillips. Really? Lyle was great as the detective in The Player. Oh, God, I forgot he's in that. Oh, that's right.
Huh.
Sam Phillips, female folk singer, was the mute but still very effective hench person in Die Hard with a Vengeance. No, it's not a great movie, but I thought she was great in a very unexpected role. I saw the movie, I don't remember her, but I don't remember most of that movie.
She's mute.
Yeah. Oh, and she adds, I almost forgot, Alex Karras in Blazing Saddles. Mongo only pawn in Game of Life.
What was he? Was he a football
player? He was a football player, okay. Yeah. That's it. He went on to do other acting, but that was, I think, his first actual role. Roland, the headless Thompson Gunner Hardy, says, I'm also going with Robin Williams and Garp. Okay. Adam Mark says,
okay, here
hey,
you.
Kid, tell your old man to drag Walton and Lanier up and down the court for 40 minutes. Sorry, for 48 minutes. The way this question is worded, I think it's looking for a true non-actor performance as opposed to performers whose primary gig is singing, etc.
Either way.
But act semi-regularly, like Bette Midler, Dolly Parton, or Lady Gaga. My vote is for...
She's not French.
Sorry, Clayface.
I think she's from Virginia.
My vote is for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in his cameo in Airplane. Really? It's a short role, but his comedic performance is amazing. His performance as the co-pilot who the little boy, by visiting the cockpit, recognizes as K.A.J., ooh, aren't we hip, despite his increasing denials, is just so good, and then his snapping out of character to cuss out the kid's critical father is golden. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie. It's completely in sync with the rest of the film's relentless humor, but really stands out. K.A.J. just owns it. He's a natural in front of the camera. Yeah, okay, that is a great sequence.
Sure. I mean, to me it's fairly obvious that he's looking off camera to read his lines, but okay.
Yeah, there is that. I still like him in Game of Death, the movie that kind of stars Bruce Lee for maybe a third of it.
Well, but the only reason to watch that is because you can't imagine anybody that big being beaten with his reach, but that's a great fight. That is a great fight.
Yep. Regan McStravick says, Vinnie Jones, the soccer player, in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, among other things. And, of course, there are numerous musicians who made the crossover, especially rappers for some reason. Will Smith, LL Cool J, Ice-T, Madonna. Madonna's a rapper?
There's something I don't want to hear. Yeah. Especially now.
George Saulnier says, Dwight Yoakam in Sling Blade. Basically unrecognizable and terrifying as the abusive father. Yes, we would all like some French fried taters, please.
Did he really base his entire performance on a Muppet?
He might have, I don't know. AJ Sheems?
Shems is what I've heard, so.
Shems, okay. Adam Sandler. Wait, what? Both Punch Drunk Love and Uncut Gems. Really impressed me both times. I didn't expect it in the slightest bit. Okay, you could argue that, because in most of his other movies, he's doing his Adam Sandler comedy bits, but he actually tries to act in those two.
Okay.
I've never seen them. I'm told they're really good.
They're Sandlerific.
And of course, Master of Penguins, Gut Puncher of Walruses, and consumer of back bacon, Vince, from the Great White North, says, I think I will have a small theme to my answer this week. The two main actors I thought were also rock stars first. David Bowie is so perfect in The Man Who Fell to Earth and went on to prove he was good in any number of roles. The first role was one only he could pull off by giving the character a lot of depth where I think others might have been less subtle about it. The second is Bjork in Dancer in the Dark.
No, didn't see it.
I don't know that. OMG, what a performance. If you haven't seen it, take your antidepressants beforehand and have a supportive friend on call to help you deal with the ending. Oh, okay, dear. Why am I not shocked that an Icelandic woman made a depressing movie?
Well, and remember, Vince is a huge fan of Werner Herzog and Wim Wenders.
Yeah, Captain Cheerful.
Yeah.
Well, but those were terrific. But Mike, what about you? Who's your favorite, who really surprised you in a pleasant way?
I'm going to go with Deacon Jones in The Odd Couple. Because... You know,
really?
No.
I didn't think so. He's supposed to be an actor.
I think, did he also show up in the Brady Bunch? I think he did. Yes, he did. He showed him.
He's going to go.
He showed up both times as Deacon Jones.
Yeah.
The famous Deacon. The
famous
that Deacon had Jones. He not appeared in the Brady Bunch and The Odd Couple, I would never have
no
heard
idea
of him.
Who he was.
No,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a broad thing. I'm going to just yank something out of last week and say currently Don Rickles.
But he was an actor.
Not
even
at that point. Even at that point.
Yeah, he was. He was doing all those beach. He was doing all those beach blanket bingo movies.
I'm sorry, that wasn't acting. That was typing. I couldn't pick anybody. I couldn't think of anybody that. I mean, I didn't see A Star Is Born. Apparently, Kris Kristofferson's actually really good in it. I could easily pick Barbara Streisand for What's Up, Doc? Except she won. Didn't she win an Oscar for? Hello Dolly, not Hello Dolly, the other one.
No.
Was it
Funny
Hello
Girl?
Dolly? Funny Girl.
I don't think she won for Hello Dolly. Yeah, and she was nominated. She'd been nominated for many, yeah.
So she was still, and is to this day still mostly known as a singer, but I do love her in that film. So if you don't like Deacon Jones or Don Rickles or Barbara Streisand, then I don't know what to do. But what do you have as an answer?
Well, with all respect to Dave... I love Truman Capote in Murder by Death. I mean, that's his only film role, and he is hilarious.
Yes, but is it on purpose?
I don't know. Who cares? I just enjoy it so much. But the other one I really like is Sam Kinison in the Rodney Dangerfield movie Back to School as the history professor who just keeps losing it on his students.
How about Bobcat Goldthwait in Tapeheads? It's a tiny part, but he's really good in it.
It is a very...
Cash flow.
That's right. Don Muzzo. That's right. Yeah, although he's listed in the credits as Jack Cheese. He is. They don't mention Robert Goldthwait at all. Huh. It's just Jack Cheese.
Well.
There are a lot of them. Sure. I got to go with those two are the most fun.
Sure.
But these were all great answers. Thank you, folks, very much.
Very.
And we want to hear more. We want to hear more about a Kaiser Blade. Sorry, I'm stuck in Billy Bob mode.
Billy Bob Levine.
Star Wars forever changed the science fiction genre. What movie was a genre game changer for you?
Oh.
Could be the same science fiction, but like, what changed a genre for you?
Like Deep House or Warfare 3.
Rogue Warfare 3 changed the Rogue Warfare genre forever.
Yeah.
Or maybe it changed the warfare genre and made it go rogue. And at the end of the show, we'll tell you how you can answer this burning question.
Ooh, painful rectal itch.
That's got to be good jam. There's a deeper. 1970s Saturday Night Live. But
when it was funny.
Yeah. Ouch. True, but harsh. But now, there's things. The facts. Budget. This is up to this point, and I'm not sure he ever passed it. I have to check this on some others.
He did.
He did surpass this. This was up to the point, both Roger Corman and New World Pictures' most expensive movie at $2 million.
Yeah.
He made his money back. Box office took in about $3.6 million. And if you count video rentals over the next about 10 years, well, 20 or 30, because there weren't any video rentals until the 80s, made over $11 million.
Wow. Well, you know what?
Yeah.
Good for Roger.
Yeah, good for him. He also sold the foreign distribution rights for $750,000.
Hmm.
Most of that budget went for the salaries for two people, Robert Vaughn and George Peppard.
Yep.
Corman, you would think it went for the special effects. You would be wrong.
Oh.
So Corman approached several companies to do the special effects, but nobody would do it for less than $2 million.
Well, yeah, he obviously picked Corman, the right place, but we'll get back to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Corman then, he decided, well, I'm going to create my own special effects department.
Wow.
And he hired a young model maker and director who was later basically fired. He was fired twice and rehired twice. This kid named Jimmy Cameron. I didn't think so.
Nah.
Jimmy Cameron, by the way, also, he became the art director for the movie, built a lot of the models himself. And he hired a friend of his, this kid he who needed a job as a carpenter and a painter, this kid named Effin' Bill Paxton.
Oh, it's his fault.
Yes, Bill Paxton worked on these sets and models and everything else on Battle Beyond the Stars.
The bacon kind?
Sorry,
another deeper.
James Cameron also, he began to notice something about Corman. If Corman showed up while they were still working on the sets, he hated them. Like, I don't like it. This is terrible. And he'd start firing people on the spot.
Oh, dear.
However, if he arrived and the set was half finished, but nobody was working on it, he always liked them. So finally, what Cameron would do was have someone on lookout for Corman's car, and whenever it was spotted, he'd clear the set of crew members, no matter what state it was in. Corman would come in and go, yeah, this is good.
That's so weird.
Apparently he hated to see people working on it. I don't know. Huh. According to an interview with the star, Richard Thomas,
mm-hmm.
John Boy,
mm.
Now this should not really come as a shock. The wardrobe department had a difficult time keeping the top of Sybil Danning's costume on.
Yeah.
And had to resort to using Band-Aids to prevent said top from slipping off.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. This is considered, and with good reason, to be the first major theatrical film to be scored by one James Horner.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. He worked for... His last couple included, of course, Humanoids from the Deep and The Lady in Red, also Corman movies.
Mm-hmm.
This was his breakthrough science fiction adventure blockbuster, and he'd go on to do some minor films like Aliens, Titanic, Avatar, won a couple of Oscars for Titanic, and a lot of movies. And of course, he did do the score also for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Pretty cool. As the newscasters around the high holidays always say, for our Jewish friends, there are a lot of inside jokes in this. I mean, Robert Vaughn's character's name is Geld, which in Yiddish translates into gold or money, from the German Geld,
yeah,
meaning money.
Yeah.
The written language, which appears on the Malmori, the bad guy's screens, is Hebrew. And
nice.
Cayman, the lizard guy, his twin Kelvin assistants are named Urim and Thummim, which is mentioned once. Urim and Thummim are terms used in ancient Jewish traditions to designate parts of a high priest's robe, like the breastplate and the crown part.
Max, I hate to correct you, but they were actually, that was the name of Odin's crows, his ravens were...
That's Hugin and Munin. Thank you very much, you clod.
I'm pretty sure.
This is, I'm pretty sure you're a clod.
Oh.
The main body of the Hephaestus space station was made from a plastic terrarium salvaged from a dumpster.
Man, you know, it's amazing what you can do with trash if you've got the skill. That's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, you would not know. Now, this film does have some callbacks to... Well, and we'll get to this Magnificent Seven.
Oh.
Not only, yeah, think about it.
I was thinking Robert Seven Vaughn, Samurai, but yeah, same thing.
Robert Vaughn is actually in the Magnificent Seven as Lee, who is a character oddly similar to his character Gelt. Some of Gelt's dialogue is lifted almost verbatim from the Magnificent Seven. It's clearly being a tribute.
Yeah.
George Peppard was originally considered to play Vin, the Steve McQueen character, in The Magnificent Seven.
Hmm.
Interesting touch.
Yeah.
The good guys, or the planet victims of the evil Sador, are natives of the planet Akir, and they're known as the Akira.
Yeah.
This is, of course, a tribute to Akira Kurosawa, whose film The Seven Samurai served as one of the inspirations for this film. Hmm. Now, this one I just like. Remember Viewmasters?
Sure. GAF.
GAF Viewmasters. This was a... I don't even know how you describe it. It was like a slightly jazzed up slide viewer for personal slide viewers. Well,
it was
3D. Viewers.
That was the big deal. It was a 3D.
Yeah, it was like the 19th century stereoscopes, but smaller and more compact.
In color.
A Viewmaster 3-reel packet was issued featuring 21 images from this movie.
Ooh.
Yes, it's also the only one of Roger Corman's films to be marketed with a Viewmaster tie-in.
How many movies were?
not many. James Horner's score for this film was also used in the trailer for Roger Corman's unreleased film version of The Fantastic Four. We'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, probably.
And, yes, it was also reused in the 83 sci-fi film Space Raiders and the 1985 fantasy film Wizards of the Lost Kingdom, all Corman films. Both of those films also reused footage from Battle Beyond the Stars, one of Corman's cost-cutting trademarks, when additional footage is needed.
Hey, the man knew how to make a film cheap.
He did. He always made money on his films.
So I do have a question. Are you done with your trivia?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Sorry. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. I have a big question.
This movie is Julia Duffy's debut.
Oh.
She plays his sister.
Okay.
Julia Duffy, for those of you who don't remember, played Steph on the show Newhart, a.k.a. Coppers!
Oh!
Yes. One of the assistant editors on this movie got this gig because he had a really rough stint playing a humanoid in Humanoids from the Deep, which was released the same year.
Was this considered a bonus or something?
Possibly a punishment.
No.
I mean, maybe wearing those humanoid suit was the punishment.
Wow.
Speaking of odd cameos, actress-comedian Kathy Griffin is seen in an early shot as an alien extra reacting to a spaceship landing. I looked for her, I couldn't see her, but she's apparently in there.
Mm.
Now, most importantly, this film was considered a major influence behind the short-lived animated series The New Adventures of He-Man, 1990.
Uh-huh.
In that series, the peaceful planet Primus is under threat from the evil Flog and his mutants. Master Sebrian, the elderly leader of Primus, decides that they must find a great warrior to help deal with Flog and his evil mutants, and Hydro and Flipshot are sent to find that warrior, and that warrior they find to help in the crisis is He-Man.
Okay.
Fascinating. Yep. That's it. What was the question you wanted to ask?
Well, so last week you mentioned that you wanted to watch mm-hmm. this film, and we are, in fact, watching films directed by Roger Corman.
Yes. And I'm glad you brought
that
up.
This film, as I saw in the credits, was directed by Jimmy.
Yes, Jimmy Murakami, who, by the way, was not really a director before this. However, he was an animator who has one absolutely legendary piece of animation that I know you know, and I bet a lot of people still remember. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? One, two, three. Crunch. That was him.
Wow.
Yes, his name is on there. However, it is an open secret that Roger Corman's fingerprints are all over this movie. He actually did a lot of the directing. He just didn't want to be credited for it.
Okay.
Yes.
Because otherwise it wouldn't count, and we'd have to stop right now.
Yeah.
Turn this show right around and go right home.
And Jimmy Murakami, who went on to direct a couple of other of Corman movies, really appreciated it. Corman wanted to give him the spotlight and give him the chance. One thing you can say about Corman, he never tried to steal the spotlight from anybody, and he was perfectly willing to highlight other people.
Is that me in the spotlight?
I think that's you in the corner.
Oh, yeah, right, losing my religion. But speaking of that...
Oh, there it is.
Tell us a story. Mm-hmm. Tell us... Now, I love it when people do a really good homage. Tell us a good homage, Max.
Welcome to the agrarian planet of Akir. Everything is nice there, and everyone lives by the code of the Varda. which is cunningly never explained. But then, horror! The evil John Saxon, I mean, Sador, shows up and gives them a week, excuse me, seven cycles, to utterly surrender to him, or he will use his solar converter not to provide cheap, clean electricity, but rather to destroy their entire world.
Boo.
Oh, noes! The Akirans realize they must fight, but basketball is a peaceful planet. They have no weapon. Sorry.
That's a deeper.
Enter the innocent but brave farm boy, Shad. Huh, why does that sound familiar? Yeah. He volunteers to take the planet's only spaceship, a sentient ship named Nell, and run away to safety. I mean, go out and hire mercenaries. That's what I would have done. Go out to hire mercenaries to protect Akir. Despite having basically nothing to offer, Shad manages to bring together a strange and diverse collection of fighters. A reptilian Zyme hunter, they're kind of like snipes, named Kamen, five representatives of a clone hive mind named Nestor, Gelt, the cold-eyed professional assassin who just wants a place to hide, a folksy space cowboy from Earth, and a battle-hungry Valkyrie. Seriously, that's what her people are called, the Valkyrie. Who brings two major attributes to the fight. Oh, and a pretty blonde scientist lady. So Shad has someone to make out with. Together, they wage a desperate battle against overwhelming odds and devastating scenery chewing, culminating in an epic space battle from which only one victor emerge. The film. So, Mike, had you seen this before?
Yep.
Where'd you see it?
In the theater when it came out.
Well,
that's the place to see it, so really. I mean, the small screen was okay, but I don't think it really does. Well, I don't want to give anything away, but.
Yeah, you do need the scope. I first saw it at a science fiction marathon.
Oh.
And I had not actually heard of this movie before that, but I think the marathon was in the 80s, so it wasn't like it was that late.
Oh, and they were just showing it?
Yeah, I think it was like one of those special presentations where they have to spend a little extra money and get like an exclusive.
Oh, that's cool.
That was very cool.
Yeah. Boy, man, I wish I just saw it in a regular theater with a couple of friends. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, you know, I got to see it with a bunch of, you know, excited fans and stuff. That's really neat.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So I've seen that. I probably have seen it some point between here and then. I mean, there's so many movies, you can't rewatch them all. But
yeah,
it's been a long time since I have you seen it since the science fiction?
I don't think I have,
Oh, weird. I'm surprised you didn't go back to really it.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to find. There was a lot of difficulty with the rights as to who owned what, so it didn't come out on video for a long time.
Oh, he didn't forget to copyright this one.
No, he did not.
That was weird. So
yeah,
we got a big cast this week.
And we got some remarkable people in here.
We do.
We got George Peppard.
Yeah, the leader of the A-Team himself, although I don't think he'd done that yet.
No, I don't think so. That was later in the 80s.
I think so.
But he had done an awful lot of cowboy parts.
Oh, sure.
So this
and war pictures.
Playing space cowboy wasn't that much of a stretch.
Well, and he brings that sort of gravitas that you want to this part, right?
I didn't think about gravitas. I think he was more comfortable, you know?
Yeah, I could see that.
He's the one, he's very relaxed in it. He just sort of, he's the one who doesn't seem to be taking himself quite as seriously as the others.
But I think that that's actually part of the character, and I think that he's trying to express the idea that apparently us Earthers have a sense of humor, which apparently the rest of the galaxy does not.
Yeah, but yeah, everyone else is pretty serious in this. So he's sort of a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, he does feel very comfortable in that way. Like an old plaid shirt, flannel shirt that you like,
yeah.
Robert Vaughn?
Yeah. Yeah, he talked about gravitas.
Yeah, I think that he really embodies this character. Now, I didn't see Magnificent Seven. I've only seen Seven Samurai.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm. So I don't know his character from that. But this, I actually like the idea that he's this, you know, very well-known and very successful bounty hunter to the point that he's the only one left on his own planet. And what does he want for a payment? He wants a place to hide and a good meal. He's got no company. Yeah. He's sad.
Surrounded by treasure, but he has nowhere to spend it. And when, you know, Shad tells him, you know, all we can offer you is a meal and a safe place. He's like, yeah, you know, right now that sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. I mean,
it is.
You get to the top of your game and,
character. Yeah,
what can you do? So, I will say there's still that moral ambiguity he brings to the character, where is he fighting for himself? Is he fighting to win against something and get something in return? Or is there actually a glimmer of hope that he's doing this because it's the right thing to do?
Maybe. I want to get back to him, too, because the character's really interesting.
Yeah.
Then we got Richard Thomas, John Boy of the Waltons, and he's going out a bit of a stretch on this one, although he is still kind of like the naive, wholesome farm boy.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the guy was really typecast in the show that he was very successful in. If I remember correctly, he left the show before it ended. I think the last... I think because his character moves off or something. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
But I think that Richard Thomas was feeling his being typecast and moved on. I don't think he didn't come back. I think there were times when he came back, but I don't remember it that well. But man, that is a tough role to get typecast in, right? Because if people only see you as John Boy, and I'm sure he got called John Boy for a long time, you know. So taking a role in a science fiction film, I can understand him wanting to just kind of break free and stuff. And while the role is reminiscent, I suppose, if you want to be that way, I think he really takes the role and tries to make it his own. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's trying to stretch. It is, again, the Luke Skywalker farm boy in a strange situation.
Well, I mean, let's...
But he becomes like a fighter. He gets very badass toward the
end. Well, and there's that moral thing again, where he's like, I can't use violence, I can't be like that, and his computer spaceship's like, you're going to die if you don't. And there's points in your own code, this thing of the Varda, we'll get back to the Varda, that tell you you're allowed to do this. And I understand. And actually, it's kind of nice to see a hero for once being a little uptight about actually killing somebody, because...
Yeah, he doesn't want to.
Yeah, mostly.
He doesn't want to shoot in the back.
Right.
He won't shoot from behind.
Although, quite honestly, shooting in the front is day. But
yeah.
So, hats off to him for giving it a go after such a successful run on a very well-known and well-loved show.
Yep. We got to get to the villain, of course.
Oh, yeah.
John Sador.
Well, what,
come on. I mean, with all of it, the name is a bit silly.
I suppose, but it really tells you everything you need to know about him, right?
Yeah,
right there.
You do. You go in right away, and it's John Saxon. And John Saxon is clearly having a great time with this character.
Well, have you seen John Saxon in anything? I mean... He's almost always the bad guy. The only time I ever saw him, he was a good guy. He actually was playing a date for Mary Tyler Moore, and I'm like...
No, he's also a good guy in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee.
Oh, I forgot that. That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. He is one of those solid, to be fair, B-movie actors. He never really had a big part, but he is a solid... You can always count on John Saxon to do...
You know what you're getting.
Yeah, he is a solid, in this case, solid bad guy, well-named. He shows really no remorse at all for what he's doing, which is what you need in a part like that.
Then we got Darlene, or Darlan, I'm not sure how you even pronounce her first name, Flugel.
Do you know her?
No, I don't. She's got a surprising list of credits. But mostly she's a TV actress.
Oh, okay.
She plays Ninilia in this, the basically love interest slash smart person.
Well, quite honestly, the one who occasionally gives Shad a good kick in the pants, which he needs.
Yeah, I think.
Now, I will admit, the next actor I know you're going to is better known for horror films. And all through the film, I'm like, is that really her name? Is her name Saint X-Men? That can't be right. Basically, it is.
It's X-Men, but
I know, but I kept thinking Charles Xavier, Cyclops. There's a Sage line today. I don't remember that character in the X-Men.
I bet there's been one since. There are a lot of mutants these days in the comic book. But yes, that is Sybil Danning, the Scream Queen. Also, this was one of the few movies she actually keeps most of her clothes on.
Most of the time.
Yeah. This was a bit of a turning point for her, because before that she was always... the sexy mistress or the bad girl who lies around naked a lot, and she became much more of an action star after this.
Yeah, and they take... There's a lot of really cool influences, different cultures that are... Oh, you talked about the Jewish element earlier. Well, she's bringing in, Germanic culture with the whole Valkyrie thing, and where she... The whole... We're warriors, and our whole thing is to fight as well as possible and then die gloriously, right? So
you have to wonder if, maybe Gene Roddenberry borrowed a little of that for the Klingons.
Well, except that Star Trek came out 14 years
ago. No, I mean for Next Generation.
The whole honor. I could be. I never thought of that. You may have a point there, because Next Gen wouldn't show up till 87. But so.
Right.
Huh.
Right. There's Dr. Hephaestus, or Sam Jaffe, who's got an incredibly long
list of credits. Oh, dear God, he's been in everything. Everything.
Yeah. He's, again, one of those actors that's that guy from that thing. And he's fine. I think he has four lines, and then we never see him
again. Well, he's a head. Let's be fair. Yes. Most of him does not appear in this film. That being said, we're bringing in another culture. We're making reference to ancient Greek culture. And, of course, Hephaestus was the smith of the gods. And he is the guy who's making stuff. He's an android builder. I was a little sorry that we didn't do... I'm always sorry when we don't do a little bit more with android stuff and, you know, the whole idea of identity and whether they're real people or not. And, of course, we actually don't see them use the androids after that, which I thought was kind of a shame.
Well, they sort of disappear.
Yeah, so...
Unfortunate, but, you know, they only could fit so much in. That there's Morgan Woodward as Kamen. Did you recognize... Well, of course, you wouldn't recognize me. He's under a remarkable makeup job.
Yeah.
But Morgan Woodward, I thought you might know from Star Trek, the original show, because he plays two different people in it.
He's not Dr. Van Gelder, is he?
Yes, he is. Okay. He's Dr. Van Gelder from Dagger of the Mind, and he's also Captain Tracy from the Omega Glory.
Oh, that's right.
The Yangs and the Combs.
Interesting back, because I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. Morgan Woodward went through so much actual psychological turmoil in playing Dr. Van Gelder that he actually had to go into therapy, and there was actually because he really poured himself into that role, and he's really good in it. It's a kind of shame that we don't get to see his face, although even with makeup, you get a lot of feeling for what's basically meant to be a reptilian creature, right? And the idea of reptiles is that they don't have feelings because they're cold-blooded, or I don't know, but I think he actually takes what could have been a throwaway role and really makes it his own.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot to do, but he throws himself into it.
Yeah.
The only one of the major actors I want to mention is the lead Nestor. You know, the... That was Earl Bone.
I'm used to seeing him with a little fence in front of his face, because he's the next-door neighbor on... Tool Time?
On Tim Allen?
Yeah, Tim Allen's show. Home Improvement. Yeah.
Really? Because I know him mostly from the Terminator movies, where he's the psychiatrist.
Right, and boy, is he a jerk in that. Is it Herbert?
He is, but
maybe he's not the guy from Home Improvement.
I didn't think he was. I thought he was. I think that's someone else.
Oh, that's all right.
He does a lot of voice acting, but yeah.
I actually like the fact that they made all of the Nestor kind of look like him. Because they do.
Yeah, they did. They tried to restructure the faces to make it look a little more like him. Yeah. And just a couple of others. I mean, there's so many people in this movie.
Oh, yeah, man.
You know, Jeff Corey, another character actor. He plays Zed the Corsair.
Yeah. Oh, and he too has been in everything.
Yeah, he's been everything. And Lux, one of the Akirans, is Marta Kristen, a.k.a. Judy Robinson from Lost in Space.
Yeah. I don't know if she liked space things and she wanted to keep going with them. I got to point out, if you go to IMDb, there was one character who doesn't have any lines. He's just a very large man in a very small costume named Quopeg.
Quopeg,
which I'm guessing is a reference to Moby Dick, just saying.
I believe so.
But his photo on IMDb is just of his crotch.
Oh, dear. Well, he doesn't say anything. He just stands there and looks muscly. I think he was a bodybuilder.
I'm guessing so. And he just, you know, he looks pretty. Oh honey, don't talk.
He is very Queequeg. He's got a harpoon. He's got tattoos. Yeah. The last one I want to mention is Lynn Carlin, who is the voice of Nell the spaceship.
How is that not Majel Barrett?
I don't know. It was made for her.
Well, it sounds like her. I thought it was her.
It does.
And then I was like, maybe she had used a stage name, but I don't. Do we know Lynn Carlin from anything? Was she?
She's done a ton of TV stuff, but she doesn't have a lot of major roles.
Was she the wife of Elliot Carlin from the Bob Newhart show?
I do not think so. Shut up, Hartley. I do not think so.
So we've got a big cast, and they're all bringing different flavors. You know, it's like stone soup, right? Everybody brings something to the pot, and you get something amazing because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
So one of the things we wanted to talk about was the Varda. So they have this code, and there's a couple of things in there. One of them, and this is actually pretty smart, especially for people that are considering themselves nonviolent. One of the first things, I think it's the first law of the Varda, to fight creatures of violence, you must use creatures of violence. So, and this is not entirely unlike the original Seven Samurai, because they were farmers, right? And they're like, well, we
don't know how to fight.
We're not allowed to. I think under the law at the time in that era of Japan, they weren't owned to have.
They weren't allowed to own weapons. Yeah.
So they had to find, you know, people of violence, in this case, samurai or ronin or whatever. And that's what they're doing here. So, you know, I can totally, it's a way of understanding something that goes against your own code, but also being willing to use it. It shows a sort of moral flexibility that I found interesting in a code like this.
That was impressive.
Yeah.
Also, I was curious, you know, the name Varda sounded familiar?
Yeah.
It's actually from Tolkien.
Oh.
In the Silmarillion,
right.
Varda is one of the Valar.
That's right.
One of the gods.
Right.
Oh. I wouldn't be surprised if Corman had read Tolkien.
Yeah. It's a genre film, and he was into a lot of different genres, so that's, that's totally possible. So we have this nice moral code that lets us know a lot about the main character, Shad, and his people without having to just spell it out. Occasionally they do, you know, quote little bits of the Varda, but that's okay. And I think it's also interesting that that's how the ship has been programmed, right? So Nell, the ship, and it's...
She also knows the Varda. I mean, it's like, I don't know, putting in the Torah into your spaceship.
Well, and doesn't this in a way reflect back from Isaac Asimov's three rules of robotics, right? Like
you're going to... That which does not live cannot harm that which does live.
Right.
Yeah, that's right out of that's the first law of robotics.
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of attention being paid to science fiction in print on the screen and, you know, just general world cultures, which is kind of interesting. And that Varda, I think, is sort of the center of it. We never actually find out I assume the Varda is the text as opposed to the actual, like maybe there was a being that was also, I don't know, but it's
left very ambiguous, which is a nice touch. The audience can fill it in themselves, not actually knowing. Yeah. One of the sequences, I want, this is a jump off, but I wanted to come back to Gelt.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because he's actually a really interesting character. There's the sequence where right before battle, these two kids come over to talk to him.
Right.
And they're like, "Mister, are you a bad man?" And they're like, why are you bad? And he has this very interesting line, "If you think different, you get called bad."
That's really, now, because of who I work for, I hear that phrase, think different, and I'm like, I don't know if we were ever called bad, but sure.
I can see that, though. The idea is that which is not understood is often called evil or wrong.
Yeah, true.
That's a very interesting philosophical and psychological point they bring up.
Oh, man, I wonder if he's trying to make a cultural comment there.
It might be. I mean, this is post-70s.
And we haven't... with Stonewall riots have already happened, of course, and gay rights are still a thing. Black rights are a thing. So, yeah, I wonder if that's what that's meant to be.
Maybe.
Yeah. We've got a... To be fair, we can't be all nice to Roger here. The story is one that has had some tread to it.
It's been done, but it's a kind of an homage, the way you could argue that the Magnificent Seven is basically a rip-off of Seven Samurai, or you can say it's an homage or a retranslating into a different genre, which is kind of what's happening here. We went from samurai movie to Western to science fiction.
Well, and this reminds me of the whole thing, I was going to mention this earlier, about the whole hero has a thousand faces and that whole thing, and how there is a certain story or type of story in nearly every culture on the planet, starting way back from, you know, when we first wrote things. So the, you know,
Go back to Gilgamesh.
Gilgamesh and his buddy Enki, who were not at all gay. But the heroes, the stories that we've been telling are the same stories all through time. And all Roger Corman is doing is taking, and actually, like, because he's bringing in bits of other cultures, he's almost saying, hey, this is the story, right? This is the one we all tell. I'm telling you this because I'm using Jewish references. I'm using old ancient Greek references. I'm pulling stuff from Tolkien. So, it's... Even on 2 million, I mean, 2 million sounds like a lot, but of course, even in 1980, that was pretty much next to nothing. We're starting to get into blockbuster.
Yeah, what was Star Wars' budget?
It was like 8, but that was a lot. And to be fair, he had a major studio backing him. New World, I think, was Roger Corman's studio, so he had
it was.
He had to scrape up the money himself, and
it was done in his studio, which was basically a lumber yard.
Wow. Okay. Because you've got some pretty expansive sets here. You know, you've got the entire planet, the Akir, and then you've got all the different
trench
spaceships.
Warfare sequences.
Yeah, and that whole that satellite thing from where the head was, Dr. Hephaestus. Yeah. That's I was going to say, the $2 million is right there. We can see it on the screen.
You can. It's all up there. It's very impressive. I did want to talk about Nestor. That's an interesting idea. The This is like before the Borg and everything. They're a hive mind.
Right, they're clones. Basically,
and they, but there's only, they, as they say, there's only one Nestor.
Right.
And like he just has multiple bodies. Which I have to say is an interesting way to sort of decrease the tension a little, because when we, and undercut the tragedy when we see them die, because Nestor isn't dead, it's just those units are dead.
Well, and they,
it doesn't matter, because he says there are hundreds of thousands of him.
They actually come up with a really clever plan to try and take down Sador. They basically know one of Sador's things is that he's having parts of himself replaced because he doesn't want to die. He wants to live forever, which, you know, that's fairly common with a lot of villains. And they send a Nestor, or they get a Nestor that's taken aboard Sador's ship. And it turns out that Sador, one of his arms is bad. So they figure they'll probably replace it with one of Nestor's, and then they can control it. And they're almost successful. They almost get him. I was on the edge of my seat. I'd totally forgotten that part.
That was very tense, where they try to make him cut his own throat.
Yeah.
And they don't mimic the entire, all the gestures. And yeah, it's really edgier seat kind of scene.
And it was also just very clever. It's like, you know, we are all Nestor, so one part of us is worth sacrificing to maybe take down this, you know, horrible menace. And it's close, but doesn't quite make it, so.
No. And their motivation is unique among the group. Also, you know, some of them are out for money or revenge or because they owe Shad a debt. Nestor wants to do this because it's interesting, because they're such an advanced intellect, they get bored, and they're worried about being literally bored to death.
Yeah.
So they want to get involved.
Yeah.
And you know, Saint X-Men, that's, you know, she's a little two-dimensional.
Yeah. But there's so many characters here, you can actually give them
the leeway. They don't have a lot of time to develop everybody. I mean, it's similar in The Magnificent Seven. Everybody doesn't get a lot of backstory.
And I remember in Seven Samurai, it's, of course, it's, oh dear God, it's the big actor, the Japanese actor,
Toshiro Mifune.
It's all in his body language. He's like this restless dog, and you instantly know all about him just by the way he moves. Yep. And to be fair, we don't have anybody exactly of that caliber here. We have, but we get some of that physicality from George Peppard.
And she is similar, though, because it's just, and it's the same in Magnificent Seven with the Chico character, in that the others, like Shad, doesn't want her along. Like, you're not going to be of any use, you know, go away.
Yeah.
And she persists the way Toshiro Mifune persists.
Yeah,
until finally he accepts her.
I got to admit, that part of the script, I have to admit, I found a little, really? You're going to turn somebody away? You're like, you have nothing to pay. That was a little
confusing. And I'm not sure what they were saying there. I don't know what Roger was going for in that.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of his message was lost. I don't want to degrade the film too much, but just, that was an interesting point. I'm just about out of my notes here. What about you? We should get to that part. We should let people...
Yeah. Well, what we actually thought. The finish.
So, Max, what do you think of this film?
Oh, my God, does this movie suck?
It's so awful.
Oh, Lord. I didn't think we could keep this up the whole show. Kudos to you, sir.
Oh, it's only because I had to edit out all the parts where I started laughing.
Oh, my God. Never mind that this is a shameless ripoff of like 90 different movies.
And not a good one. And I do have to apologize. We lied. We lied to you.
We lied so big. But it was just, you know, Mike thought it'd be funny, and I think it worked.
It's so easy to rip a movie apart. And I don't know how much people actually enjoy that. So, to be fair, at the last minute... I texted Max and said, hey, you want to try and pretend that we liked it? And he was like, I don't know if I can. So, kudos to you.
For the whole show. Oh, thank you.
There was a couple of times, because we do this, we can see each other. It's a couple of times where I had to quickly jump in because Max was losing it.
Yep.
Max, you saw this a couple of years after it came out.
I did.
What did you think?
Oh, even then, I remember thinking, why does that ship look like a uterus with boobs? I'm sorry. You really, this is very late Corman, because obviously he said, all right, you can have mercenaries. One of them has to have huge boobs.
Yeah.
And so does one of the ships.
It is a really disconcerting design, oh. James Cameron.
Thanks, James.
It's like, eyes up here, eyes at the guns. You're like, it is just so weird. It's just, it's not even like, you know, some they say that cars can sometimes, oh, that car is like a woman, the curves and everything, and they're just very, this, they're just like, we're going to take a ship, which is basically a cardboard box, stick two moose antlers and some boobs on it. Get your tape out.
yeah, pretty much.
And the rest of the ships...
Yeah, the thing is like, hello, this ship is female. You can tell by the voice and by the boobs. Yes. Yeah,
and the rest of the ships have no aesthetic quality at all. It's literally like James Cameron took some Tupperware, some glue, and shoved it in some model parts, because it's just, they're awful. There's one that looks like a giant fish.
Yeah, you know, Sador's scout ship, whatever, they look really familiar. I think they've used them in... I think we saw them in Star Crash and a couple of others.
Wouldn't surprise me. Beat me with your Sador stick.
The design
stick.
Is exactly the same. Did you also notice some of the sound effects? Like,
when Star
Cowboy
Trek,
ship starts up, it sounds like, phasers. And at one point, when one of the pew-pew guns is going, it sounds exactly like photon torpedo. I swear to God, by the way, one of those ship guns... when it's firing, literally was going pew pew.
That's not the same thing. The acting, the one actor I'm actually going to give credit to is Robert Vaughn. I think he actually
Vaughn really does.
He comes out of this without stuff stuck to him. I don't know.
No.
Poor Richard Thomas. I think he's trying, but he's just not.
I don't know what was going through his mole when he thought of taking this part.
That's,
you know,
just,
it's
mean.
Just. I'm sorry, but it's. Yeah, it's John Boy in space.
Yeah.
I guess he just was having trouble getting work.
George Peppard is moist. He's very...
George Peppard at least looks like he's having a good time.
Except that hat! What is with that hat?
Well, other thing that kind of didn't age very well is you notice there's a Confederate flag painted on his spaceship.
And hey, they don't quite say, kiss, what is kiss, show me kiss, but it's hanging
she
out in the wings.
She does almost!
And
she almost does.
Battles.
Neelie actually says, does your form have kissing?
Yeah. And then we have these space battles. And there's one thing you don't want a space battle to be, and that's dull. But even
these
worse
are so
than that,
dull.
You don't want to pause in the middle of it to pause. Because they do.
They just sort of hang out.
They're like, oh, well, we didn't win yet, so we're going to get down to the planet, and we're going to talk, maybe have some trade negotiations, and then we'll get back to our amazing space battle, which, for the most part, doesn't have two ships on the screen at the same time because it's more expensive.
Nope. Yeah. It's all ship. One ship, two ship, one ship, two ship.
I do have a couple of favorite quotes from this film. Sador,
you
son of a bitch, here I come. Probably.
This is Space Cowboy from this planet Earth. Oh, Lord. I got to give Peppard credit. He said that with a straight face.
I guess.
I bet he didn't do that on the first take.
Sure. And then that quote I had earlier, to fight creatures of violence, you must use... Huh? The Varda obviously is just another word for screenwriter. That's the only thing I could think of. But my favorite, and I hope that this will become a favorite of yours for years and years to come, wait for me in the Lambda Zone.
I still like when they're trying to be sexy. And Saint X-Men, who in addition to
Saint
being
X-Men.
The you know, the Klingon warrior who's into battle and death and glory, is also really into talking about sex with Nenelia.
Yeah,
in the most unerotic ways possible, where she's comparing it to like engineering.
Yeah,
and of course her.
Just with Saint X-Men, you, even as a, how shall I put this, not entirely straight man, I couldn't help but stare, waiting for that nipple to just pop out, because it really, wanted to.
She was a wardrobe malfunction waiting to happen.
Man.
God. And even when they try to get the, what is it when she's talking about, a glorious death, although they never say death, by the way.
No.
They always say end.
Yeah,
it's like they don't say life form, they say forms. And she's, John Boy says, no death, no ending is glorious. And she says, you've never seen a Valkyrie go down. Hey-o!
Well, and then we get the Nestor. My note was, here we have the marshmallow people from Planet Fluffernutter. I mean, what the hell was going on with that?
Honestly, there's a sort of interesting idea behind that, but... The way they did it, where they're all trying to move in unison, and they're just not.
Yeah, and the, one the bit where they're trying to do comic. Yeah.
Yeah, the bit where they're trying to do the joke about a hot dog, you know, Space Cowboy's giving one to say Hydra. And he lists off the all of the artificial ingredients. And go, that's what we call meat back home.
Yeah, except that meat is not one of the ingredients. It's not even a veggie dog. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But,
oh, yeah, what is it? I wrote it down. It's hydrolyzed vegetable protein, soybean meal, niacin, dextrose, and sodium nitrate flavoring.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't know what that is.
It's pink. One of the things also you should never, ever do, and that is use things that you can easily buy and remember seeing in a Spencer's Gifts in your spaceships, because your eyes go right to...
Oh, God, the Van de Graaff generators.
Yeah, the little glass spheres that, quote-unquote, do something. Yeah, yeah. Hey, I gotta go do some shoplifting at Spencer's Gifts. You wanna come?
Yeah. Oh, Lord. And,
you know, there are times
when the names.
Yeah. Sador.
The I mean, names. Come on. And what? And of course, his medical officer, whose name is?
I don't remember.
Docco.
Oh, yeah.
Docco.
Hey. Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, Docco over there with Bilbo and Frodo. I don't know.
The one I didn't get was Shad. What's that?
Well, it's a kind of fish. Which is kind of, you know, yes, you know, because he's limp and wet and uninteresting. Well, he
comes from the planet of the 70s, people. I've never seen a beiger world in my life.
Yeah, really, his character's name should have been Chad, but...
Cayman? Oh, I get it. He's a lizard, so Cayman. Yeah. Okay, I get it. And then the Kelvin, because they get hot. The only thing in this film that gets hot.
That could have been interesting.
Could it?
Yeah, do they communicate via degrees of heat?
Could it?
Which then makes you wonder, how could anyone understand them?
Yeah.
And apparently... By the way, if you apparently heat someone, they turn into purple sparkles.
Yeah, they were sparkled to death. I didn't understand that either. There's one.
It's a lot of sparkling in this movie.
There was one character, I think it's actually Robert Vaughn, who says he's worried he doesn't want to become bored to death. And my note is,
no, that's Nestor.
James, Roger, take that out of the script. Don't have any character say bored to death in this film.
Because
this movie is really boring.
So dull.
All right. We've had our fun.
Yeah.
But honestly, we deserve
this movie quite a bit.
No idea how hard it was not to laugh and to make it sound like this film had any redeeming qualities at all, because it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but well, you know what does have redeeming qualities is our poll question. Max, would you please go over our poll question again?
Sure. Star Wars, not Battle Beyond the Stars. Star Wars forever changed the way forever changed the science fiction genre. What movie was a genre game changer for you? And you can answer this question. You can email us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website, maxmikemovies.com, and leave a comment. You can also find us on the Facing Books of Faceness.
Facebook, it's just called Facebook. I'm going to edit you out, Facebook.
Under Max Mike Movies, and you can find us on the podcast of Bumpy's Choice everywhere. But we are barely halfway through our tribute to the Core Man.
We're actually exactly halfway
Yes, we are in fact exactly halfway through. I lied. The show isn't over, so we're not technically halfway through yet.
And we've done a lot of lying in this episode.
Yes, we have.
That's just to make sure you paid attention.
What Corman masterpiece are we going to check out next week?
Well, we're going to go back in time. We're going to go back to early Corman. We're talking not even 60s Corman. We're going to 50s Corman. Yeah.
Ooh, proto Corman.
Yeah, I believe it's 50s Corman. And this is one of his bigger titles. And to be fair, it's a film I've never seen. I know almost nothing about, except that it's in black and white. Ooh. We are going to watch Bucket of Blood.
Oh, God, really?
Here's the thing. I don't think it's about what you think it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't
think... I assume it's just a gore-fest horror movie. Well, I mean, a 50s gore-fest, which means, you know, I don't know, tershy syrup.
Well, it's black and white, so how gory can it be?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what they used for blood back then. They used Hershey syrup.
Sure. Well, and Hitchcock used it. Maybe this will be like that. Maybe this is going to be Roger Corman's Hitchcock-esque picture. Or...
I'm going to go on a limb and say you're wrong.
Or it's going to be a bucket of something else. But this is...
A steaming bucket of something else.
Oh, Bumpy, will you fill the bucket, please? tune in next week to find out, was it a bucket of blood or a bucket of Bumpy?
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.
And now we're halfway through.